Hello, and welcome to the One-Stop Co-op Shop podcast, your one-stop for co-op news and reviews. This week, Jason Perez is here to entertain you with some more shelf stories.
Yo, my peoples, what's up? Welcome to the One-Stop Co-op Shop podcast. I am your host, Jason. Thank you so much for stopping by for this, for me, people, special treat of an episode. So normally on the One-Stop Co-op Shop, we are all about the games, what we're playing on the table, cooperative games, solo games and everything. We got plenty of that. You got that last week. You got that next week. Every once in a while, y'all know how I roll, I will break out a special feature about the wider aspects of the board gaming industry and tabletop industry in general. So this is one of those conversations. So if you're looking for specific game coverage, then we've got plenty of other content for you. But hopefully this one is of interest to you. And there's going to be a little bit of a pitch. I'll get into all of that. So today's episode is about a brand new tabletop journalism effort, which is fairly unique in our space. And I think it deserves some attention. And if you like what you hear, maybe you might consider a subscription along the way. Full disclosure, I am a subscriber to this new outlet as of today. Anyway, so I'm talking about Rascal News. This is an online platform for now, employing a number of tabletop journalists using a different model of journalism, which I have a lot of posing. This is very exciting on the Zoom call. This is a podcast, but just know that there's a lot of posing and excitement. Three very noteworthy tabletop journalists that you may be familiar with have joined together and introduced a worker-owned, worker-centric outlet, which is very different. So we want to get into why that is happening, what's happening in the tabletop journalism space, and have a wider conversation about where we're at in the industry. So let's go ahead and introduce our guest. First of all, I'm going to go throw names into a hat. You know what? I'm going to go alphabetical order. Why not? Just make it all fair. First, you may have heard of this person in the tabletop space working with Dicebreaker, occasionally covering games, but also other features as well. His name is Chase Carter. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
All right. And now we have a person, and I admitted it to this person ahead of time, a little bit starstruck here because I follow them on Twitter. And they were very, very upfront when the D&D open license thing happened. And if you don't know what that is, go ahead and Google this too much to explain. Hasbro got themselves in really deep water. Yeah. And there was a lot of conversation about that. And this person was breaking news in the forefront. So I know they're an excellent journalist. And checking out the news, there's a lot of other stuff from them. They are Lynn Cadiga. Welcome to the show.
Hello.
Cadiga.
It depends on what part of Italy you're from. both are fine.
But if it's from America, it's just sparkling Lynn.
There it is.
I usually say Cadiga.
Sure, we're going to go with Lynn one way or the other. That's going to be great. And I'm not as familiar with this person's work because they're coming in from the TTRPG state, but they have a pedigree working in Polygon. We all know what Polygon is. And other outlets as well. Rowan, welcome to the show.
Hello, thank you so much for having us.
Zeoli? I probably should have worked that out before I joined.
Again, I think it would also depend on which part of Italy, but Zeoli sounds more like a pasta, so we'll go with Zeoli.
Bodega right. Sounds like bodega.
And it so does,
yeah.
We're doing great.
I am down with the bodega. You're speaking my language. This is the part of Puerto Rico where I'm from. Anyway, so we are going to have, like I said, a larger conversation about what's happening in tabletop journalism, which once again, this is not directly, dealing with stuff at the table, but this is how we get our information. And they give us a valuable lens into how we get the products that we get to the table. So I'm looking forward to this conversation. So where I want to start before we get into Rascal, and we're going to spend most of the conversation getting into Rascal, what I would like to know is what in the world is going on in tabletop journalism? It is layoffs. It is a lot of bad news. It is change. There's always going to be like good stuff happening, but I see a lot of angst as well out there. Is that a fair reading of the current state of things?
Yeah, I mean, I can sort of take this one just to sort of talk about the state of journalism in general is very dire. People, billionaires kind of own most outlets, and venture capitalists own the rest. And it's just not
wannabe billionaires.
And it's one of those things where venture capitalism and billionaires just don't mix well with journalism. Like, that's not who journalists are meant to serve. And of course, it's just this huge conflict of interest that always gets in the way of like real journalism and real reporting. And on top of that, Google and search engine optimization, and even to an extent AI, have really ruined direct conversions to sites, like direct click-throughs and direct ways to navigate the internet. So many ads are running on like SEO and running on Google. So if Google's broken and SEO is broken, then those ads aren't getting the clicks that they're used to and aren't generating enough money.
So SEO being search engine optimization?
Correct.
Mm-hmm. So that being, how does the say a little bit about how that's relevant in this conversation?
So when you write an article, Google automatically picks out keywords in your article to put into its search engine, basically database. So when you search something like Rascal News, you might get our site Rascal News, but you might also get a different kind of Rascal News. You might get like a Rascal News about a streamer, or Rascal News about like, oh, there's this sports team called the Rascals, and here's news about their sport. So it's just the way that Google basically sorts through all of the internet in order to deliver internet searches to the user. But they change how they format their database very arbitrarily and quite often. So while a lot of newsrooms struggle to keep up with the SEO algorithm, So a lot of newsrooms struggle to keep up with the SEO algorithm, and it directly affects their ad sales and their ad, like how much money they're making. And it has just gone down progressively over the past 3 or 4 years as Google keeps tweaking the algorithm, and also as AI continues to destroy the algorithm from the inside out.
So I guess using a metaphor, like, so Google be the doorway, right? So people are looking for your places, and Google is providing that window or the doorway to access the thing. So like Google just say one day, okay, this doorway was a rectangle before, let's make it a triangle today. Or it was on the east side of the building, let's just turn it to the west side of the building. And they're just kind of like continually moving things around. And we don't notice it from the user end because we type stuff into Google and stuff comes up. And that basic experience works the same. Of like, okay, type stuff into Google, something comes up. But on the news end, for people who are trying to actually get those eyeballs, it's like, oh, this pathway used to work and now it doesn't work anymore. And because they changed the name, or they changed the way that certain keywords flag or whatever it is. So that makes it very hard for people to actually, what you said, click through. And I have a YouTube channel, so we have the same issue. But how do we increase our click-throughs? How do we, like, we there's something there. How do we make people go, because that's where we get our money. That's where we get our access and everything. And if that's difficult, then news in general, just like people who are interested in an audience, are going to struggle.
Yeah, and then within like the realm of tabletop games specifically, you have like some really big names that are always getting clicks. Like you have Dungeons and Dragons or Critical Role for like the actual play world where people are playing Dungeons and Dragons to make a show. You have these big names that exist within, and those are the only things that get clicks. And so like every article that is written for certain sites has to then pander to those things. You have to kind of shoehorn Dungeons and Dragons or shoehorn Critical Role. And so you kind of get articles sometimes that may not even have much to do with the headline itself, but you have to frame it that way to get the SEO optimization. So it limits the creative editorial side of it that way as well. So it's really like messing you up on both sides of the search and the writing.
This is why you get headlines that you sometimes don't like, because you're like, this headline sucks. It's just this property meets this property. It's like, hey, we hate that as well. We have to play Google's game if we want to get surfaced. So it's the only circus in town, and we're all the monkeys. Yeah.
Chase can be a little cynical on his stuff. I love it, though.
We love it, too. Yeah.
Big fan.
Some of the opinion pieces you'll get on rascal.com.news are going to be pretty spicy. I really enjoy it.
Would you believe that they're even spicier before they go up on Raw School?
Oh, they're so much spicier. Yeah.
We tape it down. Yeah, we do. We do peer-to-peer editing. So each of us edits each other's pieces. And occasionally we'll get a piece where we're just like, hey, I need the other co-boss to mm-hmm. to weigh in on this. Yeah. This is a two-editor opinion. Mm-hmm.
So talk a little bit about your particular experiences. Obviously, you don't have to go into like the whole detail. On a personal level, as journalists, right? The inner experience of Chase, I'll go to you first because you were kind of angling at that of like, we don't want to do this either, but .. So talk a little bit more about that experience of like, okay, there are things that I kind of don't want to do, but the ecosystem is kind of pushing me that way.
I mean, that's
gonna have a good one.
This is the entire show of like being corporate owned journalism. So I came into journalism a little late in undergrad as a minor because I went to a school and was going to be like an English teacher, I guess, or do something. Came to journalism late, and I was taught by someone who was very old school, came from newspapers. I went back home and worked for my local newspaper in 2012, and this was around the time that if you don't follow the sort of wider industry stuff that happened, the 2010s is when Facebook really came in and broke local news. Everybody was getting like a lot of their stuff through Facebook. And so advertising in local print news was going down the drain. And the response to that was billionaires like Rupert Murdoch and other folks like him buying up swaths of local news and basically turning it into affiliate sites for Fox, CNBC, all these others, mostly Fox News. That's why a lot of rural places are large strongholds for Republican and conservative viewpoints, because their local news is owned by conservative newspapers.
Right, like Sinclair would be another one.
Yeah, Sinclair is the other
exactly.
one. Exactly. So I was brought up in this sort of like cynical environment where the news that I was, the sort of in the industry I was being taught to perform in, was actively breaking out from underneath me. I then went into internet journalism, doing a lot of digital journalism, especially enthusiast press stuff for video games, mostly around 2014 to 2017 and 18, which are protracted by two things: the pivot to video that happened and Gamergate. So I have been sort of like walking from crisis to crisis through my journalist career. And I think it has engendered in me a deep cynicism for, or I would like to say on my better days, like a realistic approach to this. So where we are today then is corporate owned journalism outfits that don't make money, because I hint, like, my personal belief is news is never supposed to be profitable. It can sustain itself. You need to pay for it so that you can sustain itself. But if it's like a sort of hockey stick line go up situation, news is not the industry to make that happen. And yet we're 10 years into a lot of venture capitalists and private equity buying up newspapers like the Washington Post, like Univision had Gizmodo before it sold to Great Hill Partners, and then Great Hill Partners piecemealed it for a lot of different stuff. And it's now in the hands of Jim Spanfelder. And so we're seeing people like these who go, we're trying to squeeze money out of the rocks of journalistic outfit, especially online journalistic outfits, and not knowing how to make those things sort of sustainable and working. And so, as you know, normally falls downhill, and as it does, it hits all of the journalists, the working people who have to make this happen. This kind of comes across in a few different ways. One of them was the 2014 pivot to video, where we said written content isn't getting us ad clicks anymore. We're going to do video content. Mm-hmm. And then Facebook came out and said, oh, we actually lied about how many numbers videos get. And so your ad revenue is just all smoke and mirrors. And mm-hmm. so that floor fell out from underneath people. A lot of folks lost their jobs. The industry contracted. And in 2 years, it built itself back up just in time for, say, the pandemic. And ad revenue once again fell out. People lost their jobs. And whoever survived had to build back up. And now 4 years later, we're in this. So it's very strange to look at like corporate journalism as this sort of like period of successively faster breaking and papering over the cracks to try to like survive just a little bit longer. And I think that speaks to a fundamental mismatch between corporate money and journalism. Like right. those two models just mm-hmm. don't work. We could pretend that they did for long enough, and now we're seeing that friction just not work anymore.
And to be clear, like, I mean, like, because people say, oh, well, these news outlets seem very profitable, CNN and Fox and all that. I think journalism, which is the act of calling truth to power and sharing truth mm-hmm. to people, like, that's different than infotainment, which is the thing that we usually get when we look at, you know, whether it's the big kind of news outlets or whether it's just kind of like in our community. Yeah. I mean, how many listicles are we going to endure?
and
you're wondering why the news bits that come into our feeds as geeks tend to be, you know, flashy, grabby, salacious, and all that kind of stuff. Well, I mean, they're trying to split that hair between infotainment and journalism. The journalists, like the people that have joined us, are trying to get their stuff in there, but it is very much, you know, struggle because there's always going to be that pressure to be like, okay, how grabby is this? How entertaining is this, et cetera.
Yeah.
So that's where we are. That's not great. In terms of that core experience, before I move on, Lynn and Ron, do you have any other similar testimonies?
Yeah, I mean, I can talk really briefly about my time. So I worked at Geo Media, which Chase mentioned, which is still owned by Great Hill, and like Jim Spanifeller is like the CEO that was installed there. And it was all about, like, I worked and I had to write about 3 to 5 pieces every single day.
Whoa.
Yeah, it's so I ended up writing a lot of, like, rewriting a lot of press releases, doing like 600 word breakout interviews. Like, I would do an interview with a director and I would write 3 pieces based on that one interview, even though that interview might have been only like 5 or 10 minutes long. And I just asked like the buzziest, catchiest, like not really like super in-depth questions, because I was like, I just need something that I can put into a headline. And it just like wasn't very fulfilling and it wasn't very fun. And I was able to do really good work in spite of that environment. But the reason that we did that is because Jim Spanifeller firmly believes that the more posts that you have, the more revenue you'll bring in.
Mm-hmm.
And we had data that did not back that up, that like actually said like, hey, this is actually the opposite of what's happening. And it didn't matter, because it was just, he had this idea and this was what we were going to do regardless of the data or the importance. So it's just one of those things where, yeah, journalism and enthusiast media sites like IO9 are just really hamstrung by the people in charge who don't necessarily have a good view on what the audience wants.
Mm-hmm.
And what journalists are capable of.
Sure. Go ahead, Ron. You have some stuff to share?
Yeah, from my perspective, I actually have the unique perspective that I have always been a freelancer. I have, since I graduated college, I graduated into the pandemic, which was a great time for jobs.
Right.
And so I've always been a freelancer. And the difficult part with journalism and freelancing, kind of going back to that SEO idea, is that if they don't think it's going to get the conversions, if the editor, like the acquiring editor who's getting your pitches, is like, ah, that's not going to get enough clicks, we're not going to take it. I've gotten multiple, like so many responses being like, this is a really great pitch and a really interesting story, but it's just not going to get enough attention. And so that's a huge element of it as well. And then I've done a lot of work. I did a psychedelic journalism with TripSitter, which is another organization that I did some work with. And there's a big issue there with like aiming for SEO, having to write the most monotonous stuff over and over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
But also in that specific realm, having to make sure that the work that you're doing is falling within like monetization guidelines.
Mm.
And so like if you have ads, if you have sponsors, you can't talk about certain things and you can't use certain words, because then the ad, like the sponsors are going to pull out. And so making sure that things don't get flagged in that way is really important. And so moving into TTRPGs, it's not as much of an issue, but that same idea of like what you write about is going to be influenced by the advertisers and what they are willing to support and what they are willing to put their money behind.
Mm-hmm. AKA D&D, AKA known brands. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That was a huge problem with Jezebel, because it was considered a brand risk for your ads to be on Jezebel, because you didn't know if it was going to be next to something that was like, abortion is healthcare, and then there's your ad, and people were like, whoa, we don't want to like associate our brand with abortion healthcare. And so that's one of the reasons why Jezebel like had a really rough time with advertisers, is because people were worried about that, those sorts of associations, which is wild. Like, you know, journalism shouldn't be beholden to advertisers like that. And yet in the case of TripSitter, in the case of Jezebel, in the case of a lot of these sites that are working towards specifically like political perspectives, it's a huge problem.
Mm-hmm. So a little bit of a left turn in the conversation, but I'm trying to kind of isolate the journalist. And then we could talk about Rascal as a journalist outfit. So there's the top-down pressure of the billionaires and the hedge fund managers and the corporate journalism, all that kind of stuff. There's also a very large pool of competition in our media, and you angled at it, which is the enthusiast media, right? So many guys like me, quite frankly, turn on cameras and we play the role of influencer. And it is all over. But that's the mode of media we're most familiar with in board gaming. Unfortunately, not a lot of board gamers have heard of like Dicebreaker or some of these other places. They're going to go to like, you know, the enthusiast media, like Shut Up and Sit Down and Dice Tower and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And then in video gaming and TTRPGs, we have streamers and we have all these folks that are, I mean, some of them call themselves reviewers and they kind of like bleed into the journalism space where it's like, mm-hmm. we're giving you the truth. We're showing you products. But then there's this whole other temptation, unclarity about, you know, separating what the enthusiast media is doing, how closely allied they are with sponsors and, you know, game makers and all kind of stuff, and actual journalism. So mm-hmm. maybe we can talk a little bit about, you know, distinguish how you see that and how you distinguish what you do from all of that.
I think I actually have a really unique perspective on this because I came into all of this. I came into journalism. I started as a stand-up comedian and started doing stand-up comedy journalism specifically. And so I moved from being a performer and an entertainer into an influencer on TikTok. And then from there, started pursuing journalism more seriously. Mm. And there was a switch that kind of happened when I kind of understood the responsibility that I had as a journalist to be giving people information that is not there at all in an influencer. Influencers don't have any kind of structure. Influencers don't have any kind of centralized like training. You just get on a camera, you just start talking, and then people start listening. Or they don't. But in the best case scenario, people start listening. And the responsibility that comes with being that figure, having that influence, is one that I think a lot of people in that position don't realize, because we're all just trying to survive. We're all just trying to make money. We're all just trying to do whatever we can to get by. And so shifting into journalism, something that's been really, really interesting, specifically working with Lynn and Chase, has been getting all of this training and learning about what these ethical responsibilities are mm-hmm. to be a journalist, to providing this information, and how to go about those procedures properly and ethically and responsibly. Mm-hmm. There is a really big bleed. I don't think that's specific to the tabletop industry. I think that is like kind of big in a lot of areas.
Yeah, like makeup.
Yeah, exactly.
Every product is going to have that bleed. It's just in tabletop gaming, it feels like the journalism is at a more immature space. Mm-hmm. And so it feels like more like we're being shilled at more, because I don't have those kind of islands where I'm reassured that journalism is happening, and I understand how real journalism is like even harder to find and all that, but it just feels like in gaming in particular that I'm just awash in influencer content and stuff that maybe even like passing itself off as journalism-ish but really isn't. So
Yeah, I mean, it's a hard balance, right? I think that there is like a lot of benefit to citizen journalism. I think that influencers, you know, influencers and content creators definitely like provide a niche for spreading the word about tabletop, and also provide like a great marketing tool for smaller indie creators that might not be able to get a hold of Polygon, right? Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of nuance there, but I think that in journalism, we are consistently, unfortunately, like, I'm probably the worst one to talk about this, because of course, like, I've created this kind of weird journo-fluencer following, which I'm very, very weird about. And I have a lot of like complicated feelings about the fact that like I have a lot of people who follow me on social media, and I'm just like, ooh, do not want to be the story.
Right.
Not what I want. But I still think that there is a lot of the way that we as journalists attempt to serve the community more than we attempt to serve ourselves. And I think that we also attempt to pursue stories that are outside of ourselves and outside of our realms of interest in order to like further the knowledge of the space and to add some like pot like net good to the information that's out there, mm-hmm. and sort of enhance like widen the knowledge lens in interesting ways. I think that like if we are required to do that in every single piece that we write, and we are required to like pursue stories that widen that lens. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I think the big thing about being a journalist, and it's like different from being an influencer, is that I don't necessarily think that we want to be the story. Mm-hmm. I don't think we want to be the story. I don't think that like I would much rather people know Rascal than know me.
Yep. Yeah, but you don't want to, like you've mentioned before, that there is like a spreading aspect to influencing. Like there, I like to think that the main message of an influencer, when it's good, not just themselves, right? that's not great. Mm-hmm. But in terms of like, you know, spreading joy, growing whatever hobby it is. Like, you know, I love this video game. I love this thing. And I just want to share it with everybody, and that kind of mm-hmm. organically at least to growth, which is a good thing. But then the streams get crossed a little bit when it comes to, okay, are these people's journalists, and what kind of ethics do they have to follow, et cetera, et cetera. I wanted to ask Chase, because you specifically worked at Dicebreaker. In terms of your own work and the larger work of a place like Dicebreaker, how hard was it to get attention in tabletop in the context of all that other stuff, where it's like you're much more likely to click on one of the influencer sites or one of the enthusiast sites than a more mainline journalism thing of Dicebreaker in the tabletop space? So did you encounter that? Was that a frustration, or were you able to kind of navigate that okay?
It was really interesting starting at Dicebreaker and learning about, because I come to tabletop through RPGs, more of a casual board gamer, but I definitely got into the business side of board gaming working with Dicebreaker these past three and a half years. And one of the really interesting things about board game is, as a hobby, y'all are one of the most like self-informed enthusiast hobbies out there. Y'all, where it comes to like, you know, getting into the comments on like Kickstarter or any sort of crowdfunding campaigns and like knowing the processes. Like, I've never met, like, because I come from video games where people have big opinions about the art, but they don't, can we swear on this podcast?
Like, sure.
Yeah. They don't know about how games are actually made. They don't know about like the labor. But you talk to a board gamer and they're like, yeah, they're using this factory, this producer. And I know that like the meeples that come from this or the cardboard that they use is going to give me this kind of product. Like, they're fantastically informed about,
yeah, like, they know
actual...
about like black core cards and like, yeah, how magic cards are made. It's crazy.
It's,
yeah.
Oh, it's really cool. But so working at Dicebreaker, we looked at that and we said the enthusiasts, like the real hardcore hobbyists, are informing themselves. We can try to like come at them, but they're not our main audience. That's why Dicebreaker has positioned itself and continues to position itself as a more general audience. We are making tabletop games, whether that's TCGs, card games, board games, tabletop, approachable for a more generalized audience, which is also why Dicebreaker plays, to a certain extent, the Google SEO game. Mm. We're not interested in making sure that our stories always get posted on BoardGameGeek or in the subreddits, or that YouTube channels are talking about our articles. We're kind of that second step that gets you from, I saw Wingspan in Target and picked it up and really liked it, what do I do now? To, I'm now following designers on BoardGameGeek and I'm like in the forums talking about this stuff. I'm like, I'm watching these channels when they put out these previews. We're the middle step in between there, because not everyone can be the really informed hobbyist. They don't want to be, they don't have that time, but they still want to know, they want to play something other than Catan. So Dicebreaker sort of tries to be the place that says, hey, this is approachable and we can write about this in a very approachable way. So it's very interesting, because like I look at it and a lot of times I will get news from that sort of stuff and dig a little deeper, but y'all will be the first on it because there are people who make their lives about just being on this stuff. But to your point, it does mean that I also see a lot of the YouTube influencer industry in tabletop, especially board games. Anytime a board game launches on Kickstarter, they're going to have four or five videos from a lot of well-known channels doing previews.
And previews.
I think previews is a really interesting thing, because like I think like Lynn said, citizen journalism is really good. And also I think that if you are an influencer online, if you're a content creator, I'm going to put big scare quotes around the word content creator. If you are a creator online, especially YouTube, I think that you should do what you feel makes you happy and is like goes with your channel. And if that means previewing games, that's cool. But I think you need to understand that that also does undercut your ability to be critical and for an audience to sort of inherently trust information that you're giving out. This is probably something you've talked about a lot and that you fairly understand. I think something that doesn't get talked about quite as much is the fact that a lot of PR, a lot of industry professionals are learning this as well. They know that influencers, people on YouTube, TikTok, social media, will toe the line, will say the message that they want to say and won't be like us and ask uncomfortable questions, ask for a follow-up, a statement about, you know, one of my favorite stories that I've done, I say favorite, one of the stories I'm most proud of is the Pandasaurus investigation I did a year and a half ago. Pandasaurus just stopped sending us stuff for a while for a lot of reasons, but like...
Okay, so we can, that's a good example of it, because there's, you know, so many of these salacious stories, but yeah, that really reveal something about how this industry works. So Panda had some difficulty with their CEO. Right.
Yeah. It was a husband and wife team, two CEOs. Yeah.
Husband and wife team. We have to rehash the whole thing, but there
you
was.
You should go read Chase's article.
Yeah.
Go read Chase's article. Exactly. On Dicebreaker.com. And so there were some negative interactions with staff, and there was some like stories getting out of everything. And there were a lot of the influencer types, like we talked about it, but it was like we didn't really talk about it. In order to get into what really happened and how people felt and how it affected the staff and all that kind of stuff, we had to turn to the journalism. And unfortunately, I mean, we have Chase, but like Chase is one person and, you know, there's not a lot of other stuff out. That's why I followed Lynn with the open license stuff for D&D, because I didn't know a lot of other people that were actually posting and digging and, you know, getting us the real story and everything. So like, that's just like, in terms of I just feel like I get this image of like the journalist is like the little guppy and swimming in these cross currents of, you know, the top down corporatism and the bottom up influencing. And do you get that feeling sometimes kind of like taking a step back that you're just kind of, you know, these little guppy finding your way? Is that the right image?
Day, it was my whole life.
Oh no! I think I touched something and
hit something real.
Oh my god! Real.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure that Chase can talk more about his investigation, but like, yeah, I think that holding people accountable is not necessarily something that influencers are interested in doing.
Right. Investigative reporting is not sexy, not to the algorithm. Yeah.
Oh, it's also like deeply, it's also like really hard, takes a lot of time, takes a lot of like emailing people. You know, like I did this really short investigation, like recently on Rascal about the public investment fund of Saudi Arabia and its connections to tabletop and its connections to gaming. And even that, it took me like, you know, they were short articles that were like 500 or 600 words, but it still took me like 4 or 5 hours to like do the digging, find all of the sources. So I'm like, I don't want to get my ass sued. So if I say like, oh yeah, the Saudis are using esports to sports wash over their horrendous human rights record, I'm going to have 3 different sources that say that for me.
Yeah.
So it's just one of the, and it just takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of consideration. And there's like a technical aspect to it as well, where it's like, you need to have these sources cited. You need to know the exact questions to ask. You need to know how to frame the story in a way where every single part of the investigation makes sense, leads into the next question that like a reader will have, and then answers it ahead of time. And then you also, you know, in my case, you have to email the Saudi government and ask them for a comment.
Wow. Did they respond?
No.
Thank God.
No.
Thank God, honestly.
I hope they lost my email. But then I had to, you know, email Wizards of the Coast. And I was like, here are 6 very specific questions about your connections to the PIF. What do you have to say? And of course they just like gave me a little comment, but I only asked questions I knew the exact answers to. And again, Chase is really good at this, and I'm definitely like more of a bull in a china shop, where Chase is like, no, you ask the hard questions last. And I'm like, but I want answers.
Yeah, I think
I want the truth.
Something that a lot of journalists, especially I think if you're coming into this younger, is hard to learn, is that journalists are not out here to make friends. And it's something that honestly I dealt with when I first started at Dicebreaker, because one of the first things that happened in my first year is I started covering smaller creators. Like, tabletop has a very large, broad indie space. These are folks that create in their spare time as a second job and put out three or four small games a year to try to make it. And for them to get coverage in a site like Dicebreaker was a dream come true. And so I had a lot of people like really look up to me. And at a certain point, like, it feels good. It does feel good to know that you are using your platform to champion smaller voices who would otherwise not have a platform. But also, if you are not careful, you get into a situation where, one, you feel obligated to continue to do that, which is not good for your own personal mental health, as I can attest. But also, you do need to keep in mind that your job, as you said earlier, Jason, is to speak truth to power. Oftentimes, and especially under a corporate model, the opportunities to talk about smaller games is few and far between because you have to do the four stories a day to survive. And then any time that's left, you might be able to do an investigative piece to do that speaking truth to power part. And so there's a hierarchy of needs as a journalist. And ultimately, I think the best friend that a journalist can have is themselves saying, you're not out here to make friends. You're not out here to show people a good time. You're not out here to like schmooze and rub elbows and any of that sort of stuff. If you piss somebody off, it means you're doing your job correctly. Like, and that's just a hard truth.
And that goes for a lot of different aspects, because there's the actual news itself, because you're talking about like reporting on difficult news stories, but just like game coverage itself. Like, it's so hard to find honest coverage of games, any game, like a tabletop game or a video game or RPG, whatever it is, like, and just like tells a straight story. It's like, okay, you know, I'm trying to find something that assesses the latest, you know, D&D edition or the adventure and everything. Oh, it's so great. It's all this, it's all that. And the journalism, and I consider like true games criticism as an act of journalism, hard to find.
Yep.
Right. Really hard to find. So, so I wanted to, I can kind of wail and kind of shake my fist at that, but like, I really wanted to have people on here to explain the cross pressures. Like, there's a reason for that, right? And I think that we've gone over a lot of the different reasons why it's just hard to have those voices to kind of shine through.
Listen, we all want to. I can personally attest that everyone up at Dicebreaker would rather just sit around and talk about like the games that they love and why they're wonderful and why they're flawed. And if we could do that all day and earn a paycheck, we would do that. Unfortunately, that's just like not what the model lets us to do. So unfortunately, like, those are the things we try to squeak in once a week, once a month on busy months. And it's why you don't get a lot of like you said, good like news as like games criticism. It's why sometimes big games will pass and we'll talk about the Kickstarter launching and then we won't mention it again, because we're three people trying to cover an entire industry and it's hard.
And speaking to the like the influencer aspect that we were talking about before, influencers very rarely do like real genuine criticism and critique of games, talking about like the negative things or the things that aren't being done so well, because there has been like this ecosystem curated in the space where any negative comment is viewed as a personal attack on the creator rather than like speaking to the work of art in a larger tradition of art or within a larger society in which we live in.
So are you talking about from the company or are you talking about from the commenters or both?
I think both. I think there has been like, there is definitely an element of like access journalism to this, where if you say something negative about a company or a creator, they will no longer let you get previews to the things that they were talking about. So you can talk about them honestly, because they don't want honest responses. They want, wow, this is amazing, you should buy it, because they want it to be more of a marketing arm than
the poll quote. Oh, the poll quote on Kickstarter, the bane of my existence. Are you kidding me? I did this whole examination of a game in 15 minutes. I told her, but then they took out the one quote, and and they put my smiling face or logo on, and that's what they see. And that's why, as to Chase's point, previews and participating in Kickstarters and whatever, is as honest as you try to make it, there's going to be just a marketing aspect to it, just inevitably in the form of it.
Oh, yeah.
Exactly. And then I think that this, again, isn't exclusive to tabletop, but I think goes to a lot of arts criticism in general across any kind of artistic medium, where if you say something negative about this artist that people love, that they have built a parasocial relationship with, that they have created as a friend in their mind, you're attacking their friend. You're not talking about the work of art that they've made. And so then really like stepping back and trying to deconstruct that and think about works of art as standalone pieces to be examined rather than an extension of the person that made them is a really important part of criticism that I think a lot of people have forgotten because of that influencer model.
Yeah. And I think the last thing that we can sort of say is that, like, with regards to being friends in the space, it's really easy to do and it's really hard to stop ourselves from doing it, but the sort of like mantra or like the chosen party line for Rascal is that we are not your friend, we are your friendly neighborhood bartender.
Yeah. So let's do it. We spent about 40 minutes talking about the state of things up down. This has been such a valuable conversation. Let's talk about Rascal because I'm so excited about the aspect. Whoa. So let's talk about Rascal first as just something from the user perspective, what they're clicking and what they're going to read. And then we'll get into the business model after that. But first, let's just talk about what y'all are offering. I'm looking at the subscription button. Jason's an influencer. He's telling me to buy something. So I'm going to go straight to the subscription page and I'm thinking about it. But what am I actually getting when I press the button? So
yes, use your powers for good, Jason.
Yeah. I mean, I could lead off by saying, like, you're getting a website that is detached from this model of needing to write about, like, needing to reproduce press releases, which is something you get anyway. You can look at a Kickstarter. You can get those emails. We're digging a little bit deeper. I think one of the most valuable things, honestly, is, like, the fact that Rowan does a lot of interviews into the actual play space, which for someone like me, I play a lot of RPGs. I don't watch actual play. That's just something I'm not tapped into.
Talk a little bit about actual play for our audience. I don't think that's a little bit outside of what we're used to, so maybe tell us what that is.
Rowan, I'll pitch to you. You're the expert.
There it is.
Yeah, so actual play is a genre of narrative medium. It's a storytelling genre where people play a tabletop role-playing game like Dungeons and Dragons and then create an improvised story out of it.
Or God forbid, another system.
Oh God, oh, not another system. Oh my God. But yeah, exactly. And so any kind of tabletop game, people create an improvised story out of it. There's like two elements to it. There's the story being made, and then you are watching the reality show of people telling this story. And so it's become really huge. We mentioned Critical Role, Dimension 20, The Adventure Zone. These are like the big names of actual play that have kind of broken their way out of the little niche. But there is such a huge realm of indie creators playing other games besides Dungeons and Dragons. And it's podcasts, it's streams, it's edited shows, and it's only been around for like 15 years. And so it's really hitting this point in the medium where a community is coalescing around it of creators, where they get to decide what the industry looks like, what the entertainment like creation process looks like, what the content looks like. It's a much lower barrier to entry of making entertainment than a lot of other mediums. And so, yeah, no one else is covering it because it's such a small niche thing that is so exponentially growing. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think that's the best way to say what Rascal is doing is we're giving you the articles. We are writing the stuff that if we worked at a more conventional newspaper or publication, we would either be told or have to tell other people, we can't write that. That's just not worth your time. Mm. We've created a place where it's absolutely worth our time because this is how we want to spend it. We are writing about smaller actual plays from like a Desi audience of Desi creators or like other parts of the world that isn't just Western Anglo creators. We're talking about the games that we're playing that we really want to talk about together. We're doing like actual play reports on the Friday called Lay It on the Table, where we just talk about an RPG we played. When they let me, I get to bring in like my expertise about Magic the Gathering and talk Hasbro for a little bit. So like there's a lot of stuff here that I think if you were like, and this is nothing but respect for like Dicebreaker, for Polygon, for Wargaming, for all these sort of sites, like they're doing this writing, but they are still attached to this model where they do have to put out a certain number of articles a day or hit traffic goals in order to stay viable. We're following up with a sort of alternative take where we can dig deep. We can do that art criticism. We can do a bit of like inside baseball business news, actual play culture, that sort of stuff. So I think you're coming to Rascal because like you're looking at these other sites and saying, I like this, but I want more. I think we want Rascal to be the more. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, we also have like breaking news. We have a lot of interviews with really cool people. I interviewed the folks at NASA who wrote the NASA role-playing game.
Yep.
I interviewed Chuck Tingle, who's like an erotica author about tabletop, about like the fact that he only plays Advanced Dungeons and Dragons and has for like 30 years. Mm. And I'm like, you're out of your mind. Like, what's going on in there? Mm-hmm. You know, we get these like really interesting people to talk to us. We also like, I mentioned my really, really short investigations into like connecting Hasbro to the public investment fund of Saudi Arabia. Mm-hmm. Like, that's not nothing.
Yeah.
But it's also like nobody else wrote about that story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Nobody. Not Polygon, not Dicebreaker, not IO9. No one connected these three dots. And I was able to because I dropped something into the chat and I was like, I'm going to take you on a journey.
This is how you know you're going to be in for it. It's like with Lynn preambles what they're about to link. It's just like, okay, I'm just going to like clear my schedule for the next 30 minutes and let them go at it. One other thing about Rascal I think is really cool is that we decided when we built this is to create an announcement page, which is essentially like the classifieds of an old newspaper, where we dedicate some part of our site to folks who want to come in and just sort of like drop a press release. In the traditional model, we were writing about press releases anyway, but this saves us some time and lets you just get right to it. And it does exist sort of separately from the rest of our writing, so you know like there is a separation there. But it is cool to just offer a little bit of a platform to folks to talk about the things they're doing and just have that bit of space. And it's been one of the coolest things to see people be like, I'm so thankful I can do this. Because like in board games and RPGs both, I think there is a dearth of marketing and PR options if you are a smaller creator. If you're a smaller designer and publisher and you're not tapped into some of the bigger markets, like it can be really hard to get people to look at your game amongst all of GameFound's projects, against all of the stuff that comes out on Kickstarter every day. Like you feel lost in a sea. And if we can give you just a little bit of like a voice to like grab a few more people, like that's cool. I like doing that.
I have a very big bugaboo about like the news article, quote unquote, that is a summary of a press release. So no,
we all do. We all hate it. We all hate having to do it. Like I had to do it at IO9.
I still do it.
Chase still does it for Dicebreaker. But it's one of those things where we're just like, we want this information up there, but we don't want to have to touch it, and we want to put it in the hands of the community. And it's just like, if the community wants to release a press release, we will happily host it. This is a free to access, free to use. No one needs to be a member to like read it or submit to the announcement section. We will give you a login and we will literally tell you, just write your press release there. We will publish it. No. Like it's one
after
of the...
like a vetting process, I assume you could just
They don't get to post it right away. We have to like look through it and
we hit the publish button. But basically, like we tell people, like if you want to submit a press release, get in touch with us and we will show you how to do it. And that means that we don't have to pretend like we are writing news when we are simply rewriting press releases.
Yeah.
Because we are rewriting it.
Yeah, it also gives a sense of like professionalism to an industry that you've said is like still very developing and doesn't have a strong journalism presence. A lot of people in like tabletop and especially in actual play don't know that like to get the attention of a journalist or get the attention of like anyone who might be able to give you a platform, you need to have a press release, you need to have a pitch, you need to be able to be like, here's a condensed version of what this thing is, please look at it. And just being able to provide that small bit of education to the space is like, I've already seen people's press releases develop because we've had people who've now posted 3 or 4 announcements on the page. And I'm like, oh, you're getting better at this.
Nice. So that is Rascal. That is what you're signing up for. There's a lot of, basically, like, the point of parasocial relationships, right? It is possible to form parasocial relationships with these three cool people. Not that they're the story, but that we trust how they think, what they're going to bring. And that if I'm going to get a piece from Chase or from Rowan, I'm going to get something that's a little bit of a different angle on it. I'm maybe likely to get something that is, I'm not going to find anywhere else that I need to know. I would like to know if the Saudi investment fund is funding my thing. I'm the kind of person that I want to know if the Department of Defense is funding my game of Call of Duty. You know, I want to know like what is happening. Who? Yes. The answer is yes.
Sorry. I'm so sorry.
Oh no, I triggered Lynn again.
I mean, yeah. I mean, you are totally right. Hopefully, if you go to our site, which is literally just rascal.news, you will find something there that you will not find anywhere else. And we are trying to be if you are interested in tabletop role playing games and you want to move beyond Dungeons and Dragons, we want to be there with you and we want to help show you that there is so much to this industry that is worth covering, worth reading, worth exploring. And there's just so many facets to it. You know, there's actual play, there's indie games, there's solo games, there's conventions, there's charity streams. Like there's so much about this industry that is so cool and like deserves to be picked apart and deserves to be treated with respect and deserves to be treated like an art form and like a cultural institution. And there's just not enough places in the internet that are doing that.
It's centered on, I just wanted to ask a quick question. It's centered on TTRPGs, which is something we're going to be pretty forward about. There are also board games and also video games. So is there capacity at Rascal to cover these things? And is there intention to broaden coverage of like the wider geeky hobby?
Yeah, I think like something that we folded into our remit whenever we started is that like if we're interested in it and we think it'll serve our audience in a certain way, then yeah, we'll write about it. Not to like scoop myself, but like I'm working on a piece that talks about the sort of board game conventions, like board game design conventions that are trickling into RPGs. We're seeing RPGs pick up a lot more physical elements, whether that's cards, tokens, meeples, like, I mean, it, or just like, you know, like the fold-out boards or flipbook boards. Those are becoming a lot more common in RPGs as a way to use physical elements to help tell that story a little bit more clear, bring it out of the theater of the mind and put it on the table. And board games have been trending towards like narrative, like basically light RPGs for a while. I mean, everything that Cephalofair does is basically a kind of like a combat focused RPG shoved into a massive box. I think Plaid Hat does a lot of these sort of things as well, where there are board games, but there's a lot of cool elements to help you tell a larger narrative story. So the cross-pollination is going on there. And so where it makes sense, we will cover it. Also, we're people. We're three people with multifaceted interests. And if they happen to cross by, we're going to write about it. Like if we think it's cool, we're going to write about it. But I think like we do come from a position where we think that RPGs are a really unique and wonderful medium and deserve a sort of like more grown-up journalistic outlet that isn't tied to the corporate model.
Also, if we get enough supporters, we could hire contributors to write about other stuff also.
Yep. a sister
outfit with Aftermath, which is Luke Plunkett and a couple other people. Luke's been on the show before, and they hit I think 2500 subscribers and they're getting freelance stuff.
Did a subscriber drive to hit that freelance. It's something that, you know, we're much younger. We're just finished off our first month, but we're already like internally like talking about what those goals look like and what we want to do. Because I think something that we need to talk about is that like we're three white people starting this site. And we're very aware of the fact that like this space is, I mean, board game and tabletop is extremely white. Boys, it has one color about it. So one of the big things that we want to do and that we'll be very frank about is that when we get a little bit of extra money, once like this is sustainable and we can live off of this, one of the first things is to get contributors, to get people on staff, to get those voices of color, those different perspectives in so that we can begin to broaden our horizons about what we cover.
I was going to make an affirmative action joke, a DEI joke, but
listen,
Jason, in this political climate,
in esta economia,
I live in Texas, Jason. It is happening all around me.
But that's also a big part of what we're doing. Until we can do that, we're trying to make sure that we're like focusing on voices of color, focusing on voices outside of the global north and the west. Like one of the first pieces that I did on Rascal was I spoke to an Argentinian journalist about a census that he did for Argentinian tabletop players and like what that looked like and what the community there looks like, and speaking to him about an investigation that he did down into an ambassadorship program that D&D did in Latin America and how that kind of fell apart. And that article that he investigation he did was like a year ago, but never got any attention because the tabletop role-playing game is so English language first and so English centered. And so being able to bring his reporting into the English speaking world and be like, hey, everyone, look at what's happening down there. Look at this like global community that we have. We're all facing the same problems everywhere. We're stronger together. So why don't we all just pay attention to what's happening to each other?
Yeah.
And I cannot let this go because I'm me, and you had Paizo workers on the show, and I had, and I'm just like a believer in like worker co-ops, and I'm kind of a socialist, people. I'm sorry, I'm going to have to out myself over here.
Oh, sorry.
This what? Model socialism that in Rascal... esta economia?
This model, you did not seek any kind of outside funding. We're not talking about, you know, billionaire funders or anything. It is worker owned. So what does that mean? How does that work? How do y'all prevent from completely collapsing into who owns this and, you know, all the stuff that we're afraid of? So talk a little bit about the worker-owned aspect of Rascal.
Yeah, I mean, I'll tackle this because we did, at first, we did have ideas for getting a funder. And then we had ideas for, like, becoming a nonprofit and getting, like, larger donations that way. And the more that we talked about it and the more that like we realized how fiercely independent our vision was and how we valued that much more than we valued having money, which is just like crazy to say out loud. But we were like, we would rather like write free than like have any strings attached. So it just became more and more clear that we wanted to do something where we were all equitable and we all have the same amount of power, and we're worker owned. We're working towards becoming a like legal partnership where we all legally own the entire thing. Right now, I'm the legal owner because taxes are insane.
Yeah.
But we have worked very hard internally to make sure that like we are all co-founders. We all get paid the same amount. We all have 90% of the passwords are shared.
That's more logistical stuff than anything.
Logistical. But like we all have the passwords. We all have the keys to the kingdom. We have figured out ways to move forward together as like a cohesive three-person group rather than like one person saying something and two other people being yes boss. Like it would be ridiculous if I was editor in chief of Rascal. Like yeah. It's absurd. So we've really worked very hard to not only establish like ground rules. We are all co-bosses. We are all going to get compensated the same, and we are all going to equally like make decisions for this company because we are building it together. Mm-hmm. And it's a lot of communication and a lot of work, but I think we really committed to this and to each other and to a lot of like very anarchist, very socialist like thought processes of like we go together or we don't go at all.
Yeah, and we're figuring out how to extend that worker ownership to like contributors that we bring in the future, freelancers, making sure that we don't like accidentally remake a capitalism where the three of us own this and then we use other people's labor. Like we're trying to make sure that as this expands, it's going to take a lot of imagination. It's going to take a lot of work because there aren't too many things that exist like this. Yep. And so figuring out those new pathways, reading into holacracies, which Lynn has just informed us about, these non-hierarchical power structures that are not the way capitalism works, and figuring out what the future looks like, because if we don't do it, no one will.
Yeah. To answer your question, Jason, explicitly about like how we don't just like, tear each other apart or like reinforce these structures, I think it's because we come from a background of sort of shared trauma working in the journalistic space. And it's a bit of a joke, but it's a bit of like, like Lynn was laid off. I'm stuck in a constant like 3.5 year contract ship with a company that doesn't make enough money to bring me on full time, or the ownership company is scared to bring me on full time. Rowan
is legally not allowed to speak about the things that
she comes up into a system that was already broken, was not offering her any sort of like real fundamental opportunities to have a full-time job, to be a staffer. We have watched the industry sort of like slowly die and fall away, and watched all of our opportunities sort of wither on the vine. And so we said, we're gonna buck the entire model and come up with something that has hopefully a lot more sustainability, a lot more staying power, and something that will last. Like, I think I put this on Blue Sky the other day. It's like something that I really want. I have two big goals for Rascal. And that is one, to make enough money that the three of us or the four or five, whatever amount of people we bring on, can make a living wage doing this, that this is sustainable. I want growth that gets us to sustainability, which means we are paid for our work. And two, I want to be able to pass this off. I want to have this last long enough that I send this to like people that I brought on, that I trained, that I gave institutional knowledge to. And I go, I'm out. I'm going to retire if the world is still around to retire in, but I'm going to give this to other people, because that's another thing that's happened in the journalism industry with all these sort of contractions, is that there's no 20-year-old desk editor or line editor to like bring you up and teach you the ways. Like we're all sort of like, I said we're learning from the ashes, and I think that's really true for a lot of journalists, is that like we have each other and that's it. So I think a lot of the stuff that like kind of binds us together is that we have to be hopeful because there's no other model.
I believe in this model totally. This is why I wanted to take this space here on my podcast, whatever platform that I have, to have this conversation, which I think has been extremely enlightening, talking about the state of journalism and why, where the little journalist guppy is swinging these cross currents, and also to foreground a place like Rascal and foreground places like Aftermath and whatever other whatever is rising from those ashes, right? Because I think that our industry needs it. I think that we are awash in a lot of things that we can't trust at the end of the day. And if we're going to get trust from anywhere, I think the journalist has to be at the center of it. And so I'm absolutely, the faces that Lynn is making, I'm just...
Rock on.
Rock on, man. I want to do my part in terms of investing in this stuff and giving platform to this stuff and having these conversations. So the three of you, thank you so much for this conversation. Do we have any parting comments? Do we have anything that we want to share with people who are potentially looking at Rascal and that we haven't covered already? I'll go down the line. Or if there's nothing, just say nothing. Say hi. Mm-hmm. Whatever you got. We'll start with Lynn. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think the only thing I'd like to mention is that every subscription helps, even the subscriptions that are free. We have a free subscriber tier that gives you access to one or two free articles a week.
Yeah, month is a little restricted.
Yeah, sorry. One or two free articles a week. And we offer these public articles that are primarily like news, breaking news pieces, or like sort of like softer pieces. Like I wrote about 6 tabletop games for Aries season last week. And I'm like, this is free.
We can do a listicle every once in a while.
Do a listicle as a treat. Any subscription helps. We have a free tier. And hopefully we can eventually convince people that we are worth paying for. But just check out rascal.news. Hopefully you like it. Thank you so much for even reading and considering our work.
Absolutely. Go ahead, Chase.
Rowan
is going to jump in. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm just going to jump in because mine's real short. Something new as of today, we actually have a pay per article model as well, where you can, if you don't want to do a $5 a month subscription, if that's not your vibe, especially for your audience who's board games, if you go on the site and you see something that's really, really interesting to you, you can pay $1 and get just that article and you'll have it. So if you want to just kind of test the waters and see what we're about, that's an option that you can go for.
Yep. For me, I think I'll leave with even if you don't subscribe to us, there is a rash of these sort of papers in these publications popping up. You mentioned Aftermath, Defector is the one that we're all learning from. They're the first ones who sort of started it off. Mm-hmm. Remap, it's just the old Vice people for video games. A couple of new ones just today. I think it was New Sequence is a science, a pop science magazine that's coming up, and they're using the same model, the Defector Aftermath model. So look at where it's happening. Hellgate, which is just for New York, right?
Mm-hmm. I love Hellgate. That's fantastic.
Yeah. Hellgate's fantastic. There's these things are coming up. So even if you don't, if you read about Rascal, you go check out the site and you're like, that's cool, but I don't think I'd get a lot out of it. There are somebody out there. Cause I think what I want to leave people with is that the internet of the last 20 years has sort of taught people that information should be free. Mm-hmm. And while I academically kind of understand that, that can't happen until the people who provide that information make a living wage until we get rid of the scarcity of paying journalists and paying those sort of people. So until then, pay for your news,
right? We have to earn our free. It's like paying taxes, right? I mean, there's a way in which this and it used to be, right? It used to be kind of folded into our taxes. There'd be a lot more money for public radio and public news and all that kind of stuff. And that all kind of broke down and we could tell that whole story.
Head Turner, CNN, how dare he?
And so please, this is our last little pitch. There's a lot of people in our industry who feel the crush of, I'm not getting what I want out of the current media because of different things. And it's like, okay, well, pay for it. And what am I going to pay for? I think that this is an excellent opportunity to, either pay for it or just press the subscription model or press a $1 of, every little bit that absolutely helps. So Link Dega, Chase Carter, Roman Zioli, thank you so, so much for spending much time talking about it.
Thank you for having us.
If you change money, change the world, people. So until next time, later, everybody.
Bye.
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 Thanks for joining us again for the One Stop Co-op Shop podcast. Check out our YouTube channel at One Stop Co-op Shop. Also, join us for games and discussion on our Discord channel. You can support us on Patreon at patreon.com/onestop or leave us a review on iTunes. Thanks again, and we'll see you next week for another Top 5 list.